This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have a post-election discussion with author and reporter Chris Hedges.
No question, this is a blow. Hillary Clinton would have been a blow, too. But the real question is, where do we go from here?
Middle East expert Phyllis Bennis gives us a briefing on the many wars of Syria.
Is it a proxy war between nuclear powers? Is it also a proxy war between Middle Eastern governments? Can ISIS be reined in? Give a listen.
Activist attorney Jeff Haas joins us for yet another dispatch from Standing Rock.
Will the pipeline be stopped? Will it be rerouted? What are the prospects of the water protectors?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. On the morning after the presidential election, we spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Chris Hedges. Chris has written several bestsellers, including Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt, Empire of Illusion, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, and War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. In this interview, Chris provides an analysis of entrenched systems of power and shares his thoughts on how we move forward to challenge a new series of repressive measures. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You've spoken about the need for an analysis of systems of power, not just individuals. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes, even the left gets caught up in this ridiculous focus on political personalities. Not that there aren't differences between political figures like Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. There are profound differences. But the military-industrial complex, the corporate centers of power, the security and surveillance state, these are the institutions that largely determine policy. And any president is captive to those institutions, which is why you have almost complete continuity between on these systemic issues between George W. Bush and Barack Obama, with this caveat, of course, that Obama's assault on civil liberties has been worse. Obama has embraced radical positions that even Bush didn't embrace, including the misinterpretation of the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act as giving the government the right to assassinate U.S. citizens. So the mainstream media essentially does two things, and we now know after the election of Donald Trump that all their endless hot air was essentially about a non-reality-based vision of the world, based on polls that were inaccurate, based on the failure of the press to take the pulse of the country and find out, you know, that deep discontent that gave us Trump. The focus on the, I would call them manufactured personalities of our political class. All of this is anti-politics. And what's frightening is that we're not talking about these systems of power that actually rule our country and determine what happens to us.
Chris, what social forces were behind Clinton?
Well, we know it was the establishment, both the Republican and the Democratic establishment, the moneyed elites. It was similar to 1972, where you saw the establishment gang up on McGovern, the Republican and Democratic establishment. So here you had the old order, the Bushes, for instance, voting for Clinton. That old Republican establishment, which threw its political muscle behind the Democratic candidate, and then, of course, Clinton was awash in money, the moneyed interests.
What about Trump? What do you think about the fact that working people came out and essentially voted against their own interests? How do you explain that?
Well, they didn't vote against their own interests. The Democratic Party has long stopped serving the interests of working men and women.
Right, but I'm talking about Trump.
Well, but it's rage, it's anger, it's a sense of betrayal. It's, you know, decades now, if we go back to the Clinton administration, of lies, beginning with NAFTA. You know, Hillary Clinton embodies everything that both sides of the political spectrum in this country loathe. She was absolutely the weakest candidate, which is why we know from the WikiLeaks emails there was an effort by the Clinton campaign to promote Trump, because they had run poll numbers that threw in doubt her ability to even beat Ted Cruz. And so you had this phenomena of the Democratic espousal. They call them the Pied Piper candidates because they wanted to lead the more mainstream candidates closer to the lunatic fringe. They encouraged the press to treat Trump seriously because faced with a Bush, for instance, or a Romney, I mean, what was Hillary Clinton but Mitt Romney in drag? faced with a Bush or a Romney, she couldn't win. So they had to cough up this self-destructive, imbecilic, narcissistic, utterly unqualified real estate developer. And what they didn't count on was how angry people were.
And those angry people are thirsty for change. When do you think reality will sink in that, yes, we're headed for change, but it may not be what they're hoping for?
Well, he'll do what every demagogue does. And he tapped into the kind of zeitgeist through trade deals and going up to Michigan and telling car executives that if they move to Mexico, it'll impose a 35% tariff and all that kind of stuff pretty quickly, because we know he's going to push through, if he can, a series of major tax cuts for the rich. You can expect to see now all restrictions on privatizing Social Security lifted. And when that betrayed working class that largely backed him finds out that they are being betrayed again, it will trigger unrest. The difference is that under a Trump administration, with these gangsters like Rudy Giuliani and Chris Christie at his side, I mean, imagine those three in the Oval Office.
The trifecta.
The harshness of the state in terms of violence, control, will be, and it's already very high, will be ratcheted up. And unfortunately, past administrations, including the Obama administrations, have really given the executive branch almost unlimited power, have stripped us quite effectively of our most habeas corpus, due process, everything else. And they'll, you know, people like Giuliani, they'll use it. So what you will get is a backlash, and then you will see state violence like we have never seen before, or we have not seen for a long time.
You've said, Chris, that you're for mass movements in the streets, you're for third parties. What do you think we need to do to defend ourselves against this anticipated assault?
Well, the greatest mistake on the left was that it didn't walk out of the Democratic Party in 1994 with NAFTA. If we had been prescient the way Ralph Nader was, and I, you know, worked for Ralph, was a speechwriter and a long supporter of Ralph and then the Green Party, if we had begun to build an alternative where the working class could go, if we had held fast to the interests of working men and women and not sold them out, then we would not be funneling people into the arms of this proto-fascist. We didn't do that. And we are broken on the left. Labor is a spent force. 11% of American and 6% in the public sector, so they can't strike. I mean, it doesn't exist. The media is corporate controlled, so that working men and women are either rendered invisible or rendered figures of ridicule, the deplorables, which really was the word that I think, you know, any pundit on CNN would embrace. We've got to begin almost from scratch, and we should have begun a long time ago, because we are now seeing the backlash characterized as a kind of right-wing proto-fascist backlash, and we on the left really don't have much to offer.
In terms of the repercussions internationally, how we're viewed if under Trump we develop a more insular policy, setting us apart from the rest of the globe, what do you think we have to look forward to in terms of international relations?
I don't think that Trump will do an insular policy, because he's going to serve the interests of corporations like Raytheon, who expanded NATO beyond Germany, despite Reagan's promise to Gorbachev that it would not be expanded beyond Germany, because it's good for their markets. You know, dropping Tomahawk missiles on Libya is good, you know, is very good for Raytheon. It got them to bail out all the power plants that went bankrupt around Boston. So that, you know, he'll serve the interests of those business elites, which are global. The arms industry is a massive industry. He, like all proto-fascists, celebrates the supposed values of the police, of the military. We already deify, I mean, all of the candidates kind of deify the military, but Trump even more so. So I think that there is a naive supposition that somehow Trump will not be as antagonistic to Russia. Well, I would be very surprised if all of those units that were just deployed in Poland, the NATO units, were withdrawn. I think Trump lacks neither the, you know, he doesn't have the experience, he doesn't have the knowledge, and finally, he doesn't have the political clout, I think, to defy the military-industrial complex, which is really, day by day, pushing us closer and closer to confrontation with Russia, which is insane.
You know, on the other hand, we've seen some movement in our direction, I think, starting with Occupy, the extraordinary victory they had in identifying a ruling class that we're not all middle class. There's a 1%. In fact, it's like a 0.1%. Right. But in any case, we had the 1%. Then the Black Lives Matter movement, and black people have historically been the train that drove the social movement, right, in this country. And they're put to sleep when Obama got elected. And then just recently, the Movement for Black Lives and the a magnificent program that they developed. And I wanted to talk to you about, because I think we're going to have to look in terms of self-defense, and we need a party to defend ourselves. And I wanted to talk to you about various planks they would have in that party, because Trump, for example, is for deportations, the death penalty, torture, increase in libel laws, take away the right to abortion, beefing up the police force, if that's possible. I mean, what kind of demands do you think that a party that we could hopefully build would put forward?
Well, I think the bedrock issue is corporate capitalism, and we have to begin to articulate a viable socialism that to give people a kind of vision of another way to order our society. And yes, you know, all of those demands come with it, but finally, the most important is ripping down the apparatus that allows corporate capital to commodify everything, human beings, the natural world, and exploit it until exhaustion or collapse. And I don't know that we've yet done that successfully. So all of those movements are very important, and the only hope we have left now is going into the street. However, we should also be aware that it doesn't matter how many protests there are for Black Lives Matter in Baltimore and Ferguson and New York, or how many hundreds of thousands of people take to the street. The police still execute unarmed men and women at the tune of 3.1 a day. Why? Because they live in deindustrialized pockets. They are redundant or surplus labor. And state terror, police terror, coupled with mass incarceration, are the only effective forms of social control that the state has to keep those people in check. And they're not going to give it up.
When people come to you, as they've started coming to us, just wringing their hands in despair, what do you tell them?
That you're going to get your energy and your hope from carrying out physical acts of nonviolent resistance. And, you know, as you well know, that, and as has happened to me, when we marched on Goldman Sachs and shut it down and were arrested, when 133 of us were arrested in front of the White House, mostly veterans, for opposing the war, those are almost religious experiences. I speak as a former seminarian. I always say to those people, they're my church. And yes, we all went to jail. And yes, but it is that solidarity with a group of people who have a conscience and a willingness to stand up to power that actually gives us the kind of energy to keep going. Retreating into individual enclaves or sitting in front of screens only fuels despair. So we're going to perpetuate ourselves the more we get out and the more we resist with other people, because it actually gives us a community. It holds up another narrative and another way of being. You reach out to other people with a conscience, and it keeps hope alive. And hope's important. I mean, we have to have a realistic understanding of the forces we face, including, of course, the assault on the ecosystem. And yet, at the same time, we can't allow despair to disempower us, because then, you know, we will sink into real misery and depression. It is grim out there.
Speaking of grim, Trump has the opportunity to reshape the direction, the composition of the U.S. Supreme Court. There's one vacancy now. Do you think Ruth Bader Ginsburg can hang in there for four more years?
Well, I don't know. I mean, after Citizens United, I've kind of given up on the Supreme Court. I think they're just another wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate state. I think liberals have their last, I shouldn't say this to lawyers, they had their last hope in the legal system. I don't hold out much hope anymore in the legal system. I mean, they have, the legal system in the Supreme Court has been most egregious in this. It's essentially stripped us of constitutional rights by judicial fiat. I mean, where's our right to privacy, for instance? Where are the courts? Where are the law professors? Where are the law school deans? It's amazing.
Where are the prosecutions against the torturers?
Well, there you go.
Who violated international law and American law.
That's right.
And Obama's formulation was, we have to look forward, not backward. And every one of those Republican candidates, there were about 15 of them in a row, it was horrifying because they all endorsed torture, Trump in the lead. John Pilger, a fellow journalist, interviewed Julian Assange. And Pilger had read over many, many of those emails that WikiLeaks released. And he talked about the way the system worked. Hillary was really the central cog of the establishment, that people and corporations and countries would give her money, and they'd give it to the Clinton Foundation, and that would get them access to her. I think that she and Bill, remember, they left the White House with nothing. They were accused of trying to steal the White House china, and then somebody paid for it, and they got to keep it. And now they're worth, what, $150 million or something. And I think they managed to build up this network and put themselves in the center of the way the ruling elite operates. Now they're gone. But does that ruling elite still hold sway over Trump?
A different ruling elite holds sway. I think Trump, for the elites, is primarily a public relations disaster. He's just another billionaire. Let's not forget that Hillary Clinton was sitting in the front row of the church at his third wedding, and he and Bill played golf and made, you know, I'm sure, the kinds of comments we saw on the Access Hollywood tape together, knowing Bill Clinton. So he comes out of that class. I mean, his daughter was very close friends with Chelsea Clinton. So, I mean, let's be clear that this is a battle between courtiers. It's not a battle between natural antagonistic political entities.
Chris, you wrote a chapter in one of your books about the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, and I thought it was really symbolic and poetic.
This was Empire of Illusion.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But it seems that kind of celebrity and falseness, which Trump represent, has a great power over people and their imagination
out. Here we have to go back to the media. I mean, the media created Trump and promoted Trump because it's all about vaudeville. It's all about the carnival. It's all about ratings. To sit down and have serious policy discussions about justice or the economy or foreign policy doesn't produce good images and doesn't get a lot of corporate advertisers very excited. And so Trump is the natural kind of denouement of a media system that is all show all the time. And I really blame the media for the creation of Trump, who, you know, in any functioning political system would never be taken seriously.
Yeah, well, one of the heads of one of the big media companies, I can't remember which, bragged about how much money Trump would bring in if they covered him. So they gave him hundreds of millions of dollars worth of free coverage for, I think, 27 hours, and they gave Bernie Sanders 22 minutes.
Right.
Chris, you said that you supported the Green Party. Realistically, what kind of force are they? Where are they located? How organized are they? What are they capable of doing tomorrow? How should people orient towards them? Is that something that we want to take seriously? We interviewed Ajamu Baraka several weeks ago, and he said our Green Party is your party. We want you to come and take it over. Is that a realistic choice for us?
Well, the Green Party, in terms of its structure, is dysfunctional in many parts of the country. There are a few exceptions, like Richmond, California. And it needs to be deeply reorganized and restructured. I supported the Green Party because if they had been able to get 5%, it would have given them easy ballot access and $10 million in federal funds. I look back on Syriza in Greece that a decade ago was polling at 4%. And we have to be – I don't think the Green Party is the optimal structure to do this, but we don't happen to have another one at the moment. But I think those of us on the left have – like Podemos in Spain, like Syriza in Greece, we have to begin to build mass movements and then political entities that give an expression to those movements if we have any hope of rolling back now this tide of kind of corporate fascism that – Trump is going to ram down our throats.
Do you think if we do that, we can win over people who initially had supported Trump?
I think the big problem is the system is quite effective in locking out those voices. So if Green Party candidates or if Nader, I mean, believe me, you do not want to debate Ralph Nader. If he had gotten on the debates and people had been able to see him pitted against the mainstream candidates, this is how Jesse Ventura ends up getting elected governor. Because he got into the debates. He was polling in the single digits when he began. And the collusion between the Democratic and the Republican establishment in terms of locking out voices, we saw that with single payer. I mean, effectively, you know, censoring any kind of serious discussion of single payer within the mainstream media and the debates by locking out Kucinich, who was the only supporter of it. This is a big problem, and it's what Sheldon Wolin, our great political philosopher, calls managed democracy. And it will be even more managed under Trump. You know, we are barreling towards a kind of species of corporate totalitarianism, and we are going to begin to experience the same kinds of problems that dissidents experienced, whether under communism or fascism or any other kind of totalitarianism.
Chris, we just have a few minutes remaining. Can you give any words of hope to our listening audience in terms of positives that might come out of this Trump administration?
Yeah, it's time for us to hold fast to moral imperatives, to stand up for the oppressed. And by that, I mean all of the oppressed, not just, you know, some of the oppressed who are convenient. I mean, we stand up with all of the oppressed like the Palestinians or none of the oppressed. And that has to be, and, you know, again, I'll go back to my kind of religious training. That has to be something that we do because it's right. In the end, I don't fight fascists because I'll win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. And that has to be our mantra. If we continue to betray oppressed peoples, then we betray ourselves and we betray everything that we supposedly stand for. And we no longer have the time or the luxury to do that.
Chris Hedges, once again, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for coming back on Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
The horrific situation in Syria is something that the American people don't know much about. And even people in the anti-war movement suffer from the lack of decent reporting. Some of the issues we need to examine are, is it a proxy war between Middle Eastern governments? Can ISIS be reined in? Should Assad go? Is that any of our business? And finally, should the American peace movement be promoting the goal of a weapons of mass destruction free Middle East? We speak today with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the New Internationalism Project, working to change U.S. policy in the broader Middle East. She was co-founder of both the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation and United for Peace and Justice Coalitions, and continues to work with both the U.S. and global anti-war movements. Her most recent books include Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict and Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a primer.
Phyllis Bennis, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with both of you.
Phyllis, how would you characterize what's happening in Syria now? Is it a civil war? Is it a proxy war? And if so, between whom?
The answer is yes. It's all of the above. There is certainly a civil war in Syria. That's the war that morphed out of what began as a nonviolent political protest movement in the context of the Arab Spring in early 2011, and was met by a very vicious government crackdown. Shortly after that, morphed into a militarized fight back that became a real civil war. Within months, that civil war had broadened to become a set of wars, so that now, when we look at Syria, it's really, well, it sort of changes day to day, but at my last count, it was something like 11 separate wars, all being fought to the last Syrian, but wars that are between forces for whom the people of Syria and even the nation of Syria mean very little. All of this goes on sort of side by side with this civil war that's underway between a large section of the Syrian population and a repressive government and its army. But those other proxy wars have become in some ways far more dominant. So you have the war between Iran and Saudi Arabia being fought for regional hegemony, being fought in Syria. You have a war so far largely a cold war, but getting unfortunately quite heated, between the U.S. and Russia over sea lanes and military bases and a host of other things. You have another war between Saudi Arabia and Iran over whether it's going to be Sunni or Shia Islam that's fought out. There's a war between Turkey and the Kurds that's being fought in Syria. So all of these wars, there's a host of them, all of these wars are being fought. And it's for that reason that we can't just talk about a negotiated solution where we bring all the Syrian parties to the table. Because right now, the Syrian parties are not, certainly not the only actors and not the only military actors, but they're not even the main ones. They're not even the ones who can call their own shots. Because this set of proxy wars involving these very powerful regional and global powers have really taken over the war field, if you will, and they are fighting for their own interests in the context of the Syrian war. So that's the real challenge, what it's going to take to get to negotiations, to get to diplomacy, when there's all these separate parallel wars being waged.
Can you talk a bit about the role that the United States plays in this? And what about congressional efforts to demand a new authorization to use military force? Is that wise?
You know, it's a very tricky question, Heidi. On the one hand, when we look at the U.S. role, as has been the case in U.S. military interventions across the Middle East, it's all bad. There's nothing good about it. We hear that, you know, the U.S. is there because of concern about civilians. Hillary Clinton wanted a no-fly zone like she did in Libya. These military actions, military responsive to terrorism, military responses in general throughout the region, orchestrated by the U.S., have all failed. They've made things worse. The U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq in 2003 is in many ways the watershed, the head of the whole set of crises that are now raging militarily across the region. Having said that, the U.S. is not the only bad guy here. There are plenty of bad guys. There's a real lack of good guys, I would say, on the military side. There's good guys who remain among the political opposition in Syria, and some of them are calling for U.S. intervention, as was the case in Libya and other places, where there's a belief somehow that things are so bad that we want the U.S. to come and save us. The problem is, of course, the U.S. doesn't ever go in to save people. It goes in and its military kills people and destroys cities in the name of fighting terrorism or defending civilians or other things like that. So the U.S. Engagement, you know, we hear a lot that the problem in Syria is that the U.S. has not engaged. The U.S. is completely engaged in Syria. What it has not done, luckily so far, is to send large numbers of ground troops. There are small numbers of ground troops that the U.S. has sent, and the U.S. is continuing its bombing. We don't hear as much about it. It's not having the same level of civilian casualties as the last couple of months of the Russian and Syrian bombing of eastern Aleppo, where the civilian casualties have been extraordinary. But there have been plenty of civilian casualties in places like Ramadi, in Idlib, in other places where the U.S. has claimed that they're bombing terrorist outfits. They claim they're bombing ISIS, and the people who die somehow are not ISIS. They're ordinary civilians who get caught in the wrong place. So the U.S. militarized intervention has made it worse, not better. What the U.S. has not intervened with enough is full-scale focus on non-military, non-armed policies that would bring about the, at least the potential for some kind of negotiated settlement. That would have to start with some kind of a move towards a set of arms embargoes on all sides. The U.S. could start that first and say, you know what? Sending arms to everybody and their brother who says they're against the regime or against ISIS or against Al-Qaeda or against whoever somehow isn't working to make things better in Syria. So we're not going to do that anymore. And in fact, we're going to tell our allies in Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Qatar and Jordan and all these countries in the region that are funneling our weapons right into Syria, and somehow they always end up in the hands of the most extreme elements, whether it's ISIS, whether it's Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, etc. We're going to tell them if they keep doing that, they're never again going to have access to U.S. military sales. Now, the chance of that happening right away is pretty small. That goes up right up against the military-industrial complex, the producers in this country of all those high-tech weapons. You know, we hear a lot, well, nobody wants this war. And, well, actually, that's wrong. Most people don't want this war, but those who do are few but very, very powerful. They're the CEOs and the shareholders of these major military corporations who are, in all senses of the word, making a killing on these wars. So the U.S. has not done that. Instead, although we kept hearing from President Obama there is no military solution, all of the high-level attention, the vast majority of the money, et cetera, went to military action. And what a surprise, it still doesn't work. The question of the authorization for that that military engagement, of course, is completely illegal at this point. The Obama administration has said they would like Congress to vote and pass another authorization that would be more specific to the so-called global war on terror. But they know that that's not very likely, and they said, in fact, we don't really need it because we can rely on the 2001 authorization, of which only the heroic Barbara Lee voted no. And that authorization, it's kind of outrageous that they even imagine that that could be used to justify wars in Syria against an organization that didn't even exist at the time of the 9/11 attacks, because that authorization gives the U.S. president from Congress the authority to use military force against those who carried out the actions of September 11 and those who harbored them, which was meant to be the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, period, full stop. It's been used ever since to justify attacks all over the world, bombing attacks, drone attacks. And the question now is if Congress, either in this lame duck session or in the next Congress, if Congress actually agreed to discuss the issue and pass a new authorization, would it be even more wide-ranging for the next president to give the next president whatever level of military credibility he wants? So it's a very tactical question whether it even makes sense to call for a new authorization. It certainly makes sense to remind the American people that these wars are being waged illegally. They have not been authorized by the Congress. Whether we want to push for another authorization knowing that it's quite likely to pass, that's a different question.
Well, that's not something that I think any of us can get excited about. Phyllis, what's your evaluation of the current strength of the U.S. anti-war movement, and what should it be doing? What kind of demands should it be raising?
You know, the anti-war movement right now is very divided over the question of Syria. It's a different kind of divide. It's a more severe divide than we've faced before. We've had divisions before. In the war, the anti-war movement against the Iraq War, for instance, there were two massive coalitions that had very different views of how to organize against the war. But both of them were against the war. Both wanted the U.S. Involvement in the war to end. What we have now is actually more than that. What we have now is a situation where there's a set of people who want to win, who support winning the war in Syria, and they come down on two sides. One side wants to, quote, win the war for the Assad regime and what's known as Syrian sovereignty, although the question of what sovereignty means in a civil war context remains very uncertain. But that's one side. Then there's another side who wants to win the war for the Syrian revolution, for the Syrian opposition. They are further divided between those who want U.S. military intervention on their side and those who don't. That's one section. The much larger section of the anti-war movement recognizes, in my view, the appropriate role for an anti-war movement in the U.S. is to call for an end to the war, not winning the war, just end it, because nobody's going to win militarily from this war. And what I think we need to focus on is what's it going to take to build the kind of powerful movement that we need, focused on the global war on terror in general, the militarization of U.S. foreign policy that war reflects in general, and the centerpiece of that war right now in Syria. So it seems to me there's four things that we could unite around. Calls on the U.S. government, some of which are also appropriate for other movements in other countries. Number one, stop killing people and stop destroying cities in the name of preventing others from killing people. So what does that mean? It means stop the airstrikes, stop the drone strikes, stop the bombing, withdraw the special forces, all of that. Number two, move towards a real arms embargo on all sides, what I was talking about earlier. That means really challenging the U.S. and global arms industry. That would make it possible to urge Russia and Iran to stop arming the Syrian regime, a terrible regime. But why should they listen to the U.S. when the U.S. and its allies are arming everybody and their brother on the other side? Number three, call for new diplomatic partnerships, not the kind of military partnership that we were talking about a few weeks ago between the U.S. and Russia that wasn't designed to end the war, but was designed to make the bombing more efficient. That's not what's going to end this war. We need real diplomatic moves, diplomatic partnerships at the regional and global levels with everybody at the table, including all the various forces in Syria. Number four, probably the only one that we have a chance of winning any time in the sooner future, and it's not going to be easy after this election, massive increases in U.S. support for refugees and the other regional humanitarian needs of people that are suffering as a result of these wars. That means making good on all the pledges to the United Nations for funds to support refugees, and it means vastly increasing the number of refugees who would be welcomed in the U.S. for resettlement among that small number of refugees who need permanent resettlement somewhere else. Those four things, I think, would be the beginnings of what we could unite on as a movement. It's going to be a very difficult task. People have very different approaches to what they want to achieve. And it's not just differences in how to organize for the same goal. So we have to recognize that and move forward with those who can be unified around a much broader approach to building an anti-war movement that's part of a broader movement, especially now with a Trump victory, with all of the anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, anti-refugee rhetoric and threats that have been made. We're going to have to build a movement that not only opposes these wars, but supports the refugees and the immigrants, Muslims, Arabs, Arab Americans, South Asians, and others who are targeted by the same policies that gave rise to this war in the first place.
Phyllis, do you have thoughts yet on really how to re-inspire a movement or people who might share the values and want to work toward the points you've just enumerated? By the time this program airs, it will be a week after the election. And what do you think are the most pressing challenges that we as activist community need to confront as we head into a Trump administration?
I think the question of movements is central, our movement and their movement. I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that we are going to be playing defense for a while. There's a movement around the Trump candidacy that contains within it a really far-right, very violent, misogynistic, racist core that is targeting women, LGBTQ communities, and particularly immigrants, refugees, Muslims, Arabs, Mexicans, communities of color. So defense of those endangered communities, I think, is going to be something that all progressives are going to need to be part of. In the context of building an anti-war movement, it means linking the defense of those communities at risk, particularly linking campaigns to support the refugees, while building campaigns simultaneously to end wars. There's talk of a new sanctuary movement. Other movements based in cities or based in states may be appropriate before we try to tackle the national policies directly. We don't really know. This is going to be a very different kind of political moment. We don't know what the policies are actually going to be. It's not clear who's going to be in charge. Is a President Trump actually going to run the country, or is Vice President Pence going to be functionally in charge? Who are the foreign policy advisors? Is he going to be relying on international corporate officials? Or we just don't know. So we have to be prepared first to protect and defend those of our communities that are at greatest risk. And then, within that, build a movement against the militarization of the world, including here in our own communities, that this latest move represents.
Heidi and I would like to thank you very much for coming back on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Thanks. It's been great to be with you.
Bye-bye, Phyllis. Thanks.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Construction of the Dakota Area Pipeline continues. It's been 2 weeks since our last interview with Attorney Jeff Haas, who's been representing the Native Americans and the protesters at Standing Rock. A lot has happened. The company is hell-bent on getting that pipeline done, and they've built it all the way up to the river, even though they do not have a permit for going under the river yet. The pipeline goes from North Dakota to South Dakota to Iowa. Winter is setting in. There are 5,000 people encamped there on October 27th with a huge military force. The governor and the armed police tried without success to roll things back. We speak today not only with Attorney Jeff Haas, but with Lila June Johnston, a Navajo Cheyenne woman who has been up there 3 times. She joins us as well to speak about what's happening and to update the report.
Jeff Haas and Lila June Johnston, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Jeff, it's been 2 weeks since our last dispatch with you. What has happened at Standing Rock in the past 2 weeks?
Well, what's happened is the pipeline has been determined that it's going to go through no matter what Obama or the Corps of Engineers say, and they've continued their construction. On October 27th, people took a stand on sacred land and tried to stop the pipeline, and they were met with a military force, a huge force of sound cannons, 200 people in riot gear, all kinds of shooting rubber bullets, shooting beanbags, shooting at horses. And over 100 people were arrested, mostly praying and protesting nonviolently. And then they ended up charging those. Somebody at one end, there was a fire of a straw bale, so they charged almost everybody, 100 people, with a felony of rioting with the use of fire, even though it had nothing to do with at least 99% of them. And they've just used huge military force to respond, and they put all this energy and resources into getting all these troops up there and this equipment. And then the people who were arrested were basically put in dog kennels. They were strip searched. They were denied bathroom and food and water. They were shipped all over the state. So on the one hand, they put tremendous resources into this military response, and they've had no concern for the rights of the water protectors. And many people who've requested attorneys have been, their applications have disappeared. So you really had acceleration both of the resistance as they get nearer the river, but also of the pipeline construction.
Who authorized the repression?
Well, it seems like Obama has sort of watched it. He hasn't sent in troops as much as hasn't done anything to stop it. But the sheriff of the county has organized this and brought in law enforcement people from all over the country under some kind of pact. And they have militarized them, and they've told them that the water protectors are violent. So they come in riot gear, and they've really been brutal. Today, even though supposedly an agreement was struck between the Army Corps of Engineers and Standing Rock Tribe, the pipeline says, we're going to keep going. We're going to go right up to the river, to the Missouri River, even though that's on Army Corps of Engineer land. So they're violating what the Army Corps of Engineers has said, and they said, we're going to go right up to the river, and they're assuming they're going to get a permit to go under the river. That has been pulled for now. But, of course, with this election, who knows what's going to happen after Trump takes over. The governor of North Dakota, the former governor, there's a new governor, or will be, was a big Trump supporter. The whole state is very Republican and very pro-oil. I'm going to put Lila June on, who's going to tell you a little bit about what the feel is for being there.
Yeah, thank you. Lila June?
Yes. On November 15th, there is a national day of action. What they're calling is for people to go to the Army Corps of Engineer district headquarters near you. So apparently there's local Army Corps of Engineers field offices in every city, or at least most cities. And so on November 15th, people on the ground at Standing Rock have organized this national day of action. And looking on their website, what they say is, with a coordinated massive demonstration across the country, we'll make it clear that this powerful movement will not allow the Obama administration or the incoming president to sacrifice indigenous rights, our water, or our climate. They must reject this pipeline. So,
June, what is the website that people can get?
It's urbannativeera.com.
And how would you describe the atmosphere there right now?
Right now, there's mixed feelings. It's a mixture of incredible inspiration, incredible hope, incredible joy. There's 5,000 people there now who came after the atrocities that occurred on October 27th, and then the second atrocity, which occurred on, I think, early November, I want to say the first or the second or third, where folks were trying to cross the river, and very peacefully, they were perfectly in their bounds of as peaceful demonstrators, got manhandled once again. So there's tons of people there. It's bigger than it's ever been. You drive out there, and it's just a beautiful sight. There's teepees for, you know, a mile in every direction. And it's just, by and large, the feeling on the ground is a feeling of great hope and just wonder and awe at the beauty and the unity of the human race around this issue.
Lila June, before we let you go, because we're coming to an end of our allotted time, I just wanted to ask you, how did you get involved in this?
Well, I think being born an indigenous woman, you kind of are automatically involved in a lot of struggles because we're separate tribes, and yet we're all the same tribe, and we're all the same people. And so what affects one tribe elsewhere, I feel like affects me. And so whether it's in New York or Canada or South America or the Philippines, if indigenous peoples are being assaulted, I feel it because it's the same thing that my ancestors went through, and it's the same thing that I've been through in my own life, and we're still going through. And so I think indigenous peoples the world over see themselves in this struggle, and they want to be there. I'm Navajo, and I'm Cheyenne, and I'm also part European on my father's side. But I did go to Sundance in the Dakotas every summer, so I feel very deep debt to Lakota, Nakota, Dakota people for the sharing that they've given to the world of their ceremony and their healing practices. So I have good friends who've been up there since day one, who've been living at this camp for 6 months. It's been trendy and popular for about, you know, 2 or 3 months, but these people have been on the ground there for coming up on 7 months straight, living in the camps there. So that's how I got involved, and it's an honor to support them, and also knowing that I have my own dragons to fight over here. We as indigenous peoples, by and large, know that we must fight these dragons with love, with prayer, with forgiveness as they're doing these things. And that's the thing I organized when I was up there. We organized a 700-people march to the Morton County Police Station to forgive them for all of the horrible things they did on the 27th. Not to say that it's okay, not to say that we allow it again, but that we are responding to their hatred with love. So that's one thing I wanted to say definitely before I part with you all.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, we have to say goodbye, but Lila June Johnson, Jeff Haas.
Thank you, and I just want to also point out that there is an international movement that is really challenging the financing of this, and banks and organizations that support the pipeline are under pressure in Europe, in the U.S., and that's also part of the focus, in addition to the Army Corps of Engineers on November 15th, is putting pressure on the financial part of the pipeline, and I think there's some possible breakthroughs there. It's really up for grabs, and it's up to the people to try to take advantage of this very brave stand by so many of our relatives.
Jeff, we wish we could be there with you, but we're definitely there in spirit. So we thank you again for this latest dispatch.
Yeah, thank you both. We'll be checking in with
you. Thank you.
Yeah. Take care.
Yeah. Bye. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.